It's been a month of protests after the killing in Minnesota of George Floyd. And it's been a protest on the street of Las Vegas. Police say there have been some 100 protests, some of them very small, some large, in the Las Vegas area. And people are demanding change. Protesters say they want police reforms. They want practices to change. Local politicians and government leaders say the same thing. But there have been some really serious issues and problems and devastating effects along the way. One Las Vegas officer was paralyzed, shot by a non-protester. That same night, a protester was shot dead by police. Lawyers and protesters have questioned Metro's tactics and handling of protests. And this is in a department that almost a decade ago was upheld as a paragon of police reform, an example of how a department with several officer-involved shootings could change. Now people are asking, can it do more? Metro says it's one of the most transparent departments in the country, and Undersheriff Kevin McMahill regularly joins us to answer questions. Undersheriff, welcome back.
Morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
You'll hear us inviting calls during tonight's State of Nevada program, but this is a rebroadcast from earlier today, so we will not be taking calls tonight. Undersheriff McMahill, first, the shooting of Officer Shay McElhaney. This was not by a protester, but by someone who it appears was some angry random shooter. This man's preliminary hearing isn't going to happen until July, but McElhaney is paralyzed now. He's 29 years old, and you were there when it happened.
I was.
And can you talk a little bit about how it happened? What happened?
Well, I can tell you, Joe, I had actually went out to, this had been probably the third or fourth night I had been out on a protest that had turned violent. And I'd went out there very specifically because not only had the sheriff and I been down at 8th and Fremont to firsthand observe our officers taking the rocks and bottles and batteries and those kinds of things, and obviously our subsequent use of pepper ball and munitions and CS gas, I wanted to see it firsthand. I didn't want to be looking at it from a camera anymore. I didn't want to be looking at it from a distance. And because we'd heard a lot of criticism, we heard a lot of people saying that we were overreacting, that we were targeting people. And so I wanted to see it firsthand. And so I was immediately behind the SWAT vehicles that were deploying the gas on this group of protesters who had become violent when we'd gotten out right there at Circus Boulevard, and they were taking a number of individuals into custody. And this individual shot Shay and hit him, and obviously he went right down there on the corner of Circus and Las Vegas Boulevard. So we were additionally fired at two more times during that event. It was chaotic. It was tragic. And unfortunately, Shay continues to fight for his life. So I just ask your listeners to continue to pray for him and his family.
The shooter, was he pretty far away? Was he very close?
He was in the driveway of the Travel Lodge, which is directly north and west of where Shay was shot from. I don't remember the exact distance that he was at when the first shot was fired. You know, there's a number of things that obviously will come out in a in a criminal trial. There's some initial reporting that he was trying to scare some protesters as well. But obviously that group of protesters had been by that location numerous times throughout the evening. So I know our investigators know a number of things. However, I don't want to disclose those until we get to the place where we can have an effective prosecution for this individual shooting our officer and gravely wounding him.
I wonder when something like this happens, you know, long-term care for somebody who is paralyzed is very expensive. And it's not like this officer can sue the shooter. So what kind of funding is available for this officer?
So the Injured Police Officers Fund has been the group that the family has asked to have donations sent to. I know between that and a GoFundMe account, I believe they've raised about $1 million for his long-term care. The family continues to work on getting him transferred out to a rehabilitation center in another state that's world-renowned. But as he continues to fight for his life, some of the challenges of infections and those kind of things have prevented the movement at this point.
And I want one more question about this. How does it affect officers, people out there who are handling the protests?
Well, listen, I mean, you see one of your fellow officers go down, and it's there's a lot of emotions that run through you during a moment like that. Certainly anger and sadness, and you want to work as hard as you can to get justice for the officer. But I can also tell you that I witnessed some extreme professionalism from all of those officers that were on the scene that night, as well as throughout that entire protest. I may have mentioned to you previously, Joe, it was a really unbelievable feeling immediately after that, because within about 5 minutes, that two groups of protesters of about 500 each, there was one downtown and one that had been traversing the boulevard south, within about 5 minutes of Shea being shot, I couldn't find a protester. I don't know why that is, but it was a really eerie feeling. It went from what was a lot of contact between police and rioters to zero contact.
Around the same time, there was another shooting. A protester in downtown Las Vegas who was openly carrying weapons, which is his right in this state, was shot and killed by police officers. Those officers, though, didn't have – it was a combination of Metro and some other jurisdictions. I don't know if it was federal officers at the federal courthouse. They weren't wearing body cameras. How come?
So the officers involved in that particular shooting were detailed to work the protest that particular evening. As you can imagine, with well over 100 protests that we've been staffing since this all started, we've had to have an all-hands-on-deck mentality. As I've said on your show many times, the people that we have equipped with body-worn cameras are our patrol force, the uniformed patrol officers. The individuals that were involved in that shooting were actually assigned to the LVMPD firearms range. They're firearms instructors. So normally they're not wearing a uniform. They wear BDUs because they're teaching our officers how to shoot. So they're not normally equipped with a body-worn camera, and that's why there's no body-worn camera footage.
Is that a mistake? Should they have them? If they're going to be in a position carrying a gun where there's going to be people potential shooting, I mean, is that being something that's changing in the future? I know that some of them, maybe this is split-second decisions that are being made, but is that going to be something you're looking at?
Well, I think it's one of those issues, as you well know, we had to negotiate to provide some additional funding to our officers to have them agree to wear the body-worn cameras. I think today, if you would ask any police officer, they think that body-worn camera is probably one of the greatest things that's ever come along for policing after the initial resistance that we received, because it tells a story. Almost each and every time, we could just press play and not even have to provide any commentary. And so I would, in a perfect world, love it if our officers had body-worn cameras, even in these events where they're going to be using wearing a full uniform, but things like detectives that work overtime and those kind of things, we don't have the equipment for them. There's a large cost to it. A lot of times they'll be sitting idle. And so I don't know exactly what the answer to your question is. I would, in a perfect world, love to have the funding to provide all of our officers a body-worn camera in the event that they're going to be deployed in a manner such as this. But we also work very hard, Joe, to ensure that we have camera coverage by using those mobile crime cameras that we have, as well as the cameras that we have along Las Vegas Boulevard and the Downtown Area Command to capture video from all of these types of incidents as they occur.
You're touching on a lot of issues I want to get to. I'm sure some of our listeners have questions or comments as well. Undersheriff Kevin McMahill is with us. He is second in command of Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and he is, you could ask him anything. We've learned over the years he is not afraid of your questions, and so bring it. If you have them out there, give us a call. I want to step one more time into the body camera area. Metro is going to charge about $280 per hour of footage from police body cams. I believe it starts tomorrow. It was $192. How come?
Well, you know, I think there's still some negotiation going on around that particular issue, Joe. The challenge is that, as I mentioned to you previously, that we had to stand up an entire dedicated group of 12 members of our organization to go through the redaction process of those videos. Now, the critics out there say you don't have to redact it, but there are laws that require that I have to redact that video before I actually release it. So It requires our redaction team to actually physically watch every minute of that video to look for personally identifying information, things that the law prohibits, you know, juveniles, juvenile faces, juvenile names, and then apply some ability to scrub faces, scrub names, scrub certain parts of that before that can be released. And the cost that is being discussed around that is what is born from having the requirement of have all of those individuals review and then redact and then release that video.
You think that price could come down? Because, you know, you're within the police department. You know, it's really a city unto its own in a lot of ways. You're surrounded by people who probably believe the same thing that you believe in terms of law enforcement. People out in public read something like that, and I know what goes on in their mind. They're thinking, oh, they're just trying to keep this stuff secret.
Yeah, I mean, I hear those criticisms all the time. There's no doubt about it. And you know, if I put myself in their shoes and take my law enforcement hat off, I understand that as well. It's sort of shocking. And so what I would also say to you is that's one of the reasons that we've been pushing these technology companies to assist us in developing artificial intelligence that we could lay over, say, a body-worn camera or any other type of video that could actually go in and then physically scrub that information for us. And so I think in the near future, there'll be some technology solutions that allow us to do this in, number one, much more rapid fashion, because that's also part of what the problem is that the courts have ruled that we have to do this in a very reasonable amount of time. And so in the past, we could do it within a month or two and just put them in the queue. And now we have literally days to get that information out.
I want to talk about something. Sheriff Joe Lombardo has talked about this on television, and it's going around in these protests, and people are talking about defunding police. Lombardo said in a TV interview he'd be okay with moving funding to other entities that should be supported, like mental health, taking the police officers out of that realm so that they're, you know, as you've talked about, that police don't become the de facto mental health institution in Southern Nevada. Actually, I want to go to a caller who has a question about that. And this is Daniel from Las Vegas. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah. So you're touching on precisely what I was going to ask. Defund the police seems to be a phrase that gets misinterpreted by people. And my understanding is it doesn't mean zeroing out police budgets and firing everybody. It means to transfer money from a police budget to, you know, let's say mental health programs. So like instead of sending an armed officer on a call for a mental health crisis, you would send a social worker. Things like instead of having armed officers doing traffic stops, have an unarmed patrol performing traffic stops and, you know, stopping people for jaywalking and things like that. Because, you know, if you go back a few years to Philando Castile, who got shot during a traffic stop while he was legally carrying a firearm, you know, that stuff shouldn't be happening. So I wanted to know what the undersheriff's thoughts are about having different people performing some of these aspects that the police are doing right now.
Yeah, hi, Daniel. So, listen, I hadn't heard the sheriff's response to that, to be honest with you, but I will tell you this. I think if anybody has been listening to this program for any amount of time, you've heard me for many years say that it's been very unfortunate that the failure of all of these social systems has become the answer to all of those failures has become to call the cops. The Clark County Detention Center remains the largest mental health facility in the state of Nevada. That's not acceptable, right? Addiction is almost always dealt with by putting somebody into the Clark County Detention Center. Homeless has become a crisis in every major American city. And who is expected to deal with the homeless issue? Police. And so I think this defund the police movement makes a lot of sense when it comes to funding other aspects of the social services system. But what I would also say to you is that things like traffic stops and those kinds of things, in a perfect world that you're not going to be confronting armed individuals and those kind of things, I'm not too sure that makes a lot of sense. But what I would also say to you is that for the first time in a very long time, we finally got back to 2 officers per 1,000 permanent residents. Cities like New York are at 4 officers per 1,000, and the LAPD is hovering right around 4. I can tell you that I don't believe we have any fat within our budgetary process at this point. We've just given back a significant amount of money this year already in budgeted unfilled positions. And so I think that the conversation needs to occur. I think that certainly additional funding for education and funding for all of the rest of these things that matter to change the way that our society is a great thing. I just don't know that. In fact, I do know. I know that cops matter in these communities, and I know that what police do matters. And I think it's very important for us to have a intelligent conversation about what the future of policing looks like so that you don't completely allow yourselves to descend into a lawless society. Because I also know that the vast majority that I of people that I continue to speak to, not only from white communities, but communities of color, want the police involved in their communities.
Undersheriff, since the protests began, dozens of people have been arrested. Police also arrested legal observers. They arrested journalists, and a Review Journal photographer was arrested. Right after that, the sheriff told the Nevada Independent that the photographer didn't identify herself, and she failed to disperse. Body camera footage shows her clearly saying repeatedly she works for the Review Journal, and she shows her ID. And this is what it sounds like.
I know that.
She's with the New York Times. Let her go. Yeah.
You don't seem to understand something.
We gave a dispersal.
How many times did we tell you this?
We will leave if you let her go.
It's past that.
Nope.
We are on a public sidewalk.
Doesn't matter, ma'am.
Now, you know, people watch and hear that. There are a couple issues do come up. One is about the dispersal order and how it applies to journalists. The other thing, right after this, the sheriff said they didn't identify themselves. You can clearly hear her identify themselves. I know people hear that and they think, why didn't he watch this video before he said that? Or was he mistaken in saying that? Give me your perspective on this.
Well, I think the controversy is that people are saying that we knew that they were journalists before we arrested them, and that's clearly not true.
But you see somebody with a camera, they have a lanyard around their neck, and the officer later in the video, and I didn't play it, says, I know, I saw you shooting photos all day.
Right. Yeah, we also had arrested several people that had T-shirts on that said they were legal observers that were not legal observers out there, Joe. And so the reality of it is that we don't provide dispersal order. Let me just back this up. I have to be a bit careful in some of my commentary because there's litigation on a couple of these cases, and you could fully expect that, and mm-hmm. I understand that. But what I will tell you is that we don't ever go out. In fact, the first night that we ended up using force on a protest, I was questioning myself for quite a long time, and I believe that I actually waited too long to order that gas to occur. We have 45 officers that have now been injured in these protests. And so when we do provide a dispersal order, there's some folks, and we've sat down with a number of defense attorneys and a number of others saying that the because of the fact that they are a journalist or a legal observer, that the laws and the rules don't apply to them. And the reality of it is that I think there's plenty of video that will back up our case in each one of these instances. But when a dispersal order is given and you are participating and you find yourself in a place where you are arrested at this point, to come up and then immediately identify yourself as a journalist after you've already been taken into custody, I think sort of convolutes the issue to say that we knew that they were journalists ahead of time. And so I don't want to get too much further into that, but the reality of it is that just because you're a journalist, and there will be people that will disagree with me on this, doesn't allow you to continue to break the law. And we've seen that in a number of circumstances. You've also seen when the sheriff played some video from the legal observers. Mm-hmm. And I think that we'll just continue to have those conversations. What I will also say to you, though, is that, listen, much of that criticism that has been leveled at us, we have continued to work to diffuse that with the various different parties. In fact, we even went so far as to invite the legal observers to one of our briefings just prior to one of the last incidents that had turned violent.
So what about, you know, after the complaints about legal observers being arrested, the department met with some national legal observer organization. They met with the ACLU of Nevada, PLAN, and other organizations. And then the next protest did not seem, you didn't see legal observers being arrested. So obviously there was room to change. I guess, is there room to change in this department? Did you do things that were differently that you didn't realize before? And should those people who have been arrested earlier, should those charges just be dropped?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they should be dropped, and I certainly believe that I wouldn't be surprised if some of them are, to be very candid with you. But I will also tell you that there is room for improvement on behavior of both sides of this issue. When we were first dealing with the very first protest that turned into a riot, I don't think that even myself as a 29-year veteran of this organization was as well prepared as I could have been. We've trained. But we also have had a very healthy respect within our community between the police and the people. And I believe that goes back to our efforts of so long in trying to get into communities and create programming, create relationships with one another so that we don't find ourselves in this scenario. We also have had many out of those 100 protests. In fact, the far vast majority of those protests have been peaceful and continue to remain peaceful. But when those individuals that come in and try to change the anatomy of what that protest looks like into a riot, it descends and changes very, very rapidly. And so, yes, there's always room for improvement. One of the things that I've said to you from the very get-go, just like it is on every officer-involved shooting that we have, is that we go back and we critique ourselves. In fact, just last week, the sheriff and I had every captain and above come back in and review all of our tactics and procedures in regards to not only protests, which we seem to be very effective at managing, but also when the protest descends into riot and how we could be more effective than what we have been.
Can you share what you think might change?
Well, I don't know necessarily that I want to get too much into what tactics would change, but what I would tell you is that there had been a number of different people that had refused to speak to us from protests. And there's fringe groups at each one of these. There's different groups of people that come in. But educating each other about the intent of the protest, where they intend to go, we will give up a lane, for example, in the street rather than insist when the crowd grows to a particular size to stay on the sidewalk. But when they go to an intersection and decide to take it over, that communication early on to say, hey, okay, you have 30 seconds, get them back on the sidewalk and let's get that moving, or 3 minutes, or whatever it is that those individual commanders are having conversations with those both legal observers and then the organizers of the protests tend to allow us to have much more peaceful protests. One thing I'd like to also say to you, Joe, in regards to this is we had a BLM protest in Doolittle Community Center. That's in the middle of West Las Vegas. We had well over 1,000 people attend that protest. That was a very peaceful protest. But the people that were protesting there were Las Vegans. They didn't allow any outside agitators. And in fact, they self-policed themselves so that none of those people, and the ones that did arrive, they were identified immediately and they assisted us in removing them. And I believe that our organization, and I only speak for Metro, but our organization, we're not against protests. We're not against protests that target the police. We realize that the actions of Officer Chauvin were not only criminal but reprehensible. The reality of it is, though, is that if we don't have real conversation, protests are designed to bring about change, right? Societal change. Riots are to bring about anarchy and chaos. They don't resolve and they don't cause anything but further conflict between the police and the people that we police and the community. That has no bearing on making substantive change, which is what everybody is talking about today.
You know, I want to talk real briefly about the outside groups. Three men, white men, former military, were all arrested for burning the police car, I think on maybe one of the first nights of these protests. There was another guy who was trying to dress like a police officer who had a SS, like a German Nazi tattoo on the inside of his arm. People thought he was an officer. In fact, they called me. I think they even called Metro and said, well, how can this guy be a cop? He wasn't a cop, but he was on the side of the cops against the protesters. Is that what we're talking about? Are we talking about the white supremacist groups out there that are infiltrating?
I think there's a variety of different groups. You also know that concurrent with these protests, we had been engaged in a month or two long investigation, counterterrorism investigation of these Boogaloo members who had intended to, not only had shown up to a number of the protests, heavily armed, full body armor and those kinds of things, but had intended to firebomb some other facilities. And so we see Antifa types, we see white supremacist types, we see people, what I always talk about, either from the fringe left or the fringe right, that don't really have any interest in people peacefully protesting. And so as we continue to go through these protests I got to believe they're going to continue all the way up until at least the presidential election. And if Congress and state legislatures can't come to some agreement on what police reform looks like, as well as the trials of these officers that have been arrested in a number of states, I think that this social upheaval will continue, and all I can hope is that cooler heads will prevail as we work together to keep these protests peaceful.
There's a question about how much reform the Metro Police Department can actually engage in, and a big part of that has to do with the PPA, the Police Protective Association, which is the police union. About a week ago, the sheriff appeared on morning TV here, and he was asked about the power of the police union. And he said, in essence, that the union is no problem when it comes to small matters. But he said when it comes to bigger matters, and I assume he meant police shootings or trying to fire an officer, he said it's a problem. And that was it. The reporter didn't ask another question. But can you tell me what that means?
So, you know, listen, we've talked over the years about an officer that we fired, and then they go through an arbitration process and they've been placed back onto our organization, and there's not a lot that we can do about it. And so police chiefs across the country are talking about these issues when it comes to identifying an officer who, say, used excessive force and they want to fire him, and then they go through these processes and they can't. And so NRS chapters 288 and 289. 289 is the Police Officer's Bill of Rights. Every year or every other year when we go to the legislature, both the unions and the organizations try to make changes in both of those to, you know, benefit their particular position. I will tell you that we haven't been successful in really getting much changed in regards to how it is that the organization is able to get rid of police officers who we don't think need to be here. I think that's also one of the things that I would implore our state legislators to look at is that they derive their power directly from what is granted at the state legislature's convening and the laws that are subsequently made in regards to that. And so it's sort of an interesting point to me to hear that everybody wants all of this police reform, and then the laws that get passed aren't helpful to the organization in that police reform.
Before we went on that break, we were talking about legislative issues that might have complicated the reforms that administrators in Metro want to have. In 2019, for instance, the Nevada legislature and the governor signed into law something that could be a very big issue. And it goes like this. A lot of police shootings, the criminal aspect is tossed out, but then they're sued civilly in federal court. A new law that's now passed in Nevada says that if any evidence against an officer in a civil matter is obtained wrongfully, then the entire case against the officer is tossed out. Now, imagine if that happened with regular people. And I hear you and others at Metro actually argued against this bill, SB 242. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That's sort of the criminal equivalent of Fruits of the Poisonous Tree doctrine, that you obtain one piece of evidence and the rest of the case is thrown out. And there's a lot of aspects of SB 242 that I don't think were beneficial to the organization when we conduct internal investigations. And, you know, a lot of that stuff is literally just complicating, right? I mean, it's very difficult to even understand how it is that you're supposed to conduct some of those investigations. And let me be clear, though, Joe, I believe our officers also deserve due process. I don't want to take that away. I mean, they deserve it as much as any other human being, and it's an important aspect of what it is that we do. I just think that a lot of these things that get pushed and then implemented into law go contrary to what I hear in regards to the effort of police reform. That just happened. That doesn't make police reform easier. And so I think that when we have these conversations at the legislative level and certainly in the special session, not only should we be talking about police reform, but we should be talking about criminal justice reform, because in my opinion, the one area of the criminal justice system that has had reform is the police. The rest of that also needs to be looked at.
Our number is 702-258-3552. I'm with Undersheriff Kevin McMahill, taking your questions, talking a lot about the protests, changes that might be needed, and joining us now from Melissa from Henderson. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to ask the undersheriff, what are the chances, what does he think the chances are that police will start to police each other instead of protecting that culture of the blue line, to hold each other to higher ethics and morals is their daily job?
That's a great question. And I wonder, is there an incentive? You know, police originally were incentivized to wear body cameras. They got extra money to wear them. And now you say it's probably not needed because they see the value in them. What about incentive? I mean, I don't want to say incentive to turn in your fellow officer, but if an officer sees somebody doing something obviously wrong, choking somebody, for instance, too long, and they don't step in, they're endangering their own careers as well. I don't know if they think about that, though, at the time.
Oh, I think they do. I mean, we've seen numerous instances of that at Metro. Melissa, I think you have a great question, by the way, and I'd just like to maybe give you a couple things to consider. Number one is there's 18,000 police departments across this great land of ours, and they're not all created equal. In fact, one of the areas of concern that I have in Minneapolis with the killing of Mr. Floyd is that the policies and procedures of the Minneapolis Police Department actually allowed for Officer Chauvin to kneel on the neck of Mr. Floyd. I can tell you that you can't find that in LVMPD policy. In fact, let me take you back to 2010, and I don't want to belabor this point for too long because I've spoke about it so many different times. But in 2010, we didn't have a policy that said that the sanctity of life was the utmost of importance as our first defining policy within the use of force policy. We also didn't have a de-escalation policy or a duty to intervene policy. All of those things have been contained within our policy for well over a decade at this point. But in many of these large organizations and many of the small organizations, they still don't have those exact same policies that we have. In fact, the NAACP came out with what they call an 8-can't-wait program, and it specifically speaks about some of those things, a de-escalation policy, a duty to intervene, a sanctity of life statement. Metro received 6 out of 8 from them, and the two areas that were not in compliance is they want the what they called a chokehold to be designated as a deadly use of force. Metro hasn't had a chokehold in, I would bet, at least 20 years. We do, however, use the lateral vascular neck restraint, LVNR. The difference is a chokehold will cut off your airway. A LVNR cuts off the blood flow to your brain.
When does that have to be used? Because I do have a question about that, too. You had the officer, Lopera,
yep,
years ago.
With Tashi Brown.
This after Tashi Brown was shocked several times, hit in the face some 13 times. Lopera put this chokehold on him. How do you deem when it's necessary?
No, no, no. And you were right the first time. The reason that we fired him was that he used the chokehold. So to finish my thought on that, though, Joe, is that One of the requests, and after we've had that conversation with them, is that they went back and said, okay, LVNR, even though it's not considered a choke, they'd still like it to be classified as a deadly force issue. And so the way that we do this at Metro is that we work with our MMEC, our Metro Multicultural Council, and the sheriff and I meet with them monthly, and they help, they give us input on our use of deadly force policy, our use of force policy in its entirety. And so we're taking that into consideration now, and I believe that we will probably be moving the LVNR to only in the instances of deadly force. So we'd be in compliance with seven of the eight. The eighth one that we are not in compliance with, that the NAACP has been demanding from agencies across the country. And mind you, some of those agencies had zero. I believe they've actually got a lot of this stuff posted on their website now, but there's another request from them that if an officer draws their firearm during the performance of their duty and actually aims it at a human being, they want us to document.
Why not do that?
That's an interesting question. We just hadn't done that previously. Mm-hmm. There's just like when we first got rifles, right? We didn't have to document when you brought a rifle out. Today, that's a documentation on a use of force report. So there's a lot of evolution when it comes to policy. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, Melissa, that the last thing I would like to say to you about that, though, is that the one thing that people really need to understand is that policy is eaten by culture all day long. And when you look, what I mean by that is you can change policy and not have any effect on the culture of an organization. Leadership is what changes culture. And the sheriff and I are very committed to making sure that Metro is held in the regard that we believe that it should be, and ensuring that not only do we change policy, but that we change the culture. And I think, you know, we have made many mistakes, and no doubt, I'm sure we will make more. But we remain committed to learning from the incidents that have happened, to hold our officers accountable, to be transparent when it does happen, and we'll continue to do that. But back to the crux of your question, I absolutely believe today that the members of my organization, of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, are very clear that the culture is if you see an officer using too much force or acting inappropriately, your duty is to intervene, to intercede, and stop the action of that officer.
We are taking your calls, and joining us now, a familiar voice to a lot of people in this town, a former head of the ACLU, Gary Peck. Gary, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. How you doing, Kevin? It's nice to talk to you.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm fine. Hey, Gary, let me just say,
hold on, Gary. Gary, before you begin, I just want to say one thing. Brevity, they say, is the better part of valor.
I know.
We have limited time. We have a lot of calls. Okay.
So someday, Kevin and I should go on a show together and talk about all of these policies because they're very complicated issues. And they're worthy of digging even more deeply into. I appreciate Kevin being on, but that's what I think, for whatever it's worth. Taser policies, data collection on stop and post-stop policing practices, which PERP calls a best practice, chokehold or lateral vascular, whatever it was that Kevin called it, an actual policy about the duty of other officers to intervene when they see a cop plainly violating someone's constitutional rights or committing a crime. I just think those are big policies. Let's talk SB 242 for a minute, because I want to commend the department for actually lobbying against that bill. But let's not get into this stuff about nobody wants to take away the due process rights of cops. Of course that is true. Cops have due process rights on steroids. There are police officers' bills of rights. There are other laws that apply only to cops, like qualified immunity. There are those collectively bargained labor agreements that give them all kinds of due process rights. SB 242 is an affront and an insult to Black, Brown, and other communities that have suffered abusive policing. It's actually an insult to Metro's management. The fruit of the poison tree, oh my God, those are litigated in criminal cases. What this rule says, what this law says is, one piece of evidence is improperly obtained, you automatically throw out, not just, it's not just thrown out in civil lawsuits, it's thrown out in interdisciplinary, in internal disciplinary proceedings. So you got that. You've got an inability of Metro to reassign an officer unless they can establish it's necessary to the effective functioning of the organization, and that can be litigated. It says that you can't question a cop if he says, I want to stop answering questions, I want my union representative here, and I want to see all the evidence against me. We're not talking about an allegation of stealing a paperclip. This could be an allegation like the one that was made against Officer LaPera, who repeatedly tased and choked someone to death.
Hey, Gary, so, how do you respond to the fact that that's what was put into law by the legislation?
I am on your side. I am on the side of the community. I think it is outrageous. The bill passed unanimously. It was a sop to the PPA. It passed unanimously in the Senate. There were three no votes in the Assembly. Let's be clear. I'm not a partisan guy on these issues. Two of those no votes were Republicans. One was a union guy who serves in the Assembly and is a Democrat. It was signed by the governor. There was nary a peep of opposition from the state attorney general. I consider it disgraceful, frankly. It's an embarrassment, particularly at this moment in time. And every single person who voted for that bill should commit to repealing it as quickly as possible. And Metro, I hope, will commit to aggressively, forcefully calling for its repeal. That's what should happen. And, you know, I've been on town hall phone calls, and immediately the conversation goes to, we want to make sure we're fair to police. We want to make sure we don't take away their due process rights. We want to make sure they have the tools to do the job. We better do some more training. Really? Did Officer LaPera need more training to know that using a low lethality weapon like a taser six times on a guy lying on the ground, punching him in the head 13 times, and choking him into unconsciousness was inappropriate? I don't think so, my brother.
Gary, I agree. That's why we fired him, Gary.
I want to ask you about this, though. The legislative session is coming up. It's 6 months away. Is this something, you know, that's on your radar?
Well, I think the special session is really, I believe the last date I heard was July 7th. And so it'll be very interesting to see what sorts of police reform processes
that's
come
true.
Out of that.
Yeah.
And the other thing, Joe, I just mentioned this again, is I don't believe that the conversation should focus solely on police reform. While I agree that there should be a conversation around police reform, I still think that there's a much larger conversation that needs to be happened when you talk about disparate sentences for black and brown people and the whole host of other issues that are out there that are not solely the responsibility of police. And I think healthy conversation around this is good for everybody.
You know, a listener emailed this morning and asked me this question, and I haven't even thought about this, wondering if the recent protests over race and police have resulted in any kind of disturbances between prisoners in the Clark County Jail?
You know, I'm not aware of any disturbances between prisoners in the Clark County Detention Center. You know, we're still dealing with COVID, obviously. We just tested the entirety of the population of the detention center, and luckily, because of the release of a number of people, as well as the social distancing that we do in there and the requirement for masks, only about 2% of that entire population tested positive. So I haven't seen that actually flare up within the Clark County Detention Center. But what I will tell you is that the sheriff and I met with the Sheriff's African American Recruitment Council last week. I have another meeting with them this week. And they brought up the issues of being both a civilian and a commissioned member of our organization, and sort of balancing this difficult time for them as members of law enforcement and members of the black community. And so really gave me a lot of things to think about from their perspective as well. And we're working together to help, you know, mitigate some of the challenges that they feel, both as a member of the organization and then going back and having the conversations with their families and their children in regards to seeing some of this just outright abuse by police officers across the country.
Yeah, I want to go back to masks. You came into our station today wearing a mask. I've seen officers on the street stopping people, talking to them, no masks. The governor has ordered everybody wear a mask in public. How come police aren't wearing masks?
So that it's still up to the individual officer's discretion to wear a mask. And one of the challenges that we have, Joe, both in – so we have the mask mandate, and the governor obviously left open for law enforcement some exception.
I'm going to stop you right there for a second. Look, I'm somebody, I get pulled over by a cop. That cop's maybe stopped 30 or 40 people or talked to them, you know, throughout the day. I want him to have a mask in case he somehow contracted COVID-19 from somebody else that he stopped.
Right. So the challenge also is that these officers have to communicate effectively with the people that they're stopping. And so a lot of times those officers are choosing not to wear them. I think what you're seeing today and what you continue to see more frequently than you have is that those individual officers that are out there with the community are beginning to wear those masks more frequently.
I'm going to ask this last question. We have about a minute in sincerity. I've gotten emails from people after it was announced you were going to be on the program asking me how you're doing.
Well, I appreciate people asking. Truth is that after Shea was shot, I had a really hard time understanding that the officer's actions in Minnesota could result in my officer being shot and paralyzed. And I needed to take a little bit of a break myself, and so I did. You know, it's Joe, you know, I've spent the better part of 15 years trying to bridge the divide between the police and communities of color. And for all the effort and work that you do, what you have to realize that as much effort and forward progress as you make, the reality of it is that it's something that never goes away, right? It's just like I was talking to an African-American the other day. He says, my skin color never goes away. And so it just sort of re-energized me in the sense that we have to double down on the community effort. We have to double down on our ability to go back out and make people believe and trust in the police, because we've always said we can't do it alone.
Las Vegas Metro Undersheriff Ken McMahill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.